Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Generation Y ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible. Starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Elon Ashkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
There are days like today where I am just too busy to get outside and go feed myself. And that's where DoorDash comes in. It's super convenient and they bring the food to me. Also, I don't like paying delivery fees. So I have DashPass. DashPass is an exclusive membership from DoorDash that gets you unlimited $0 delivery fees on eligible orders and members-only deals and discounts, all for only $9.99 a month. DashPass actually pays for itself in two orders on average. DashPass makes it easy to save at restaurants, grocery stores, and all your local favorites. Open the door to $0 delivery fees and savings you can't get anywhere else. Sign up for DashPass today only on DoorDash and get your first 30 days free if you're a new member. Subject to change, terms apply. How you doing tonight, Aaron?
I'm doing pretty good, Justin. How are you?
I'm doing all right. I got a free Nest from my power company, so I installed that today. I was pretty proud of myself.
Isn't that the thing that will lower the temperature inside your home when you're not home?
I can do it from my phone right now.
Well, I mean, but they can do it too to save energy.
We're not getting paid for this. Why are we giving them all this free press? Anyways, we are coming out to Los Angeles at the end of March.
March 24th.
I guess that's kind of mid-March. To Idle Hour from 3 to 7.
We have requests every day just about saying, when are you coming to my town? And of course, Los Angeles is a big area for us. So please, if you're in California and you can make it to Idle Hour, please go. We'd love to meet all of you.
Yeah. I mean, I spent a large portion of my life in Los Angeles, so I don't consider it my hometown, but definitely my second hometown.
And we'd like to thank Esther from Once Upon a Crime and Brianna from Murder Dictionary for helping us choose a venue.
So tonight's case is somewhat of a mystery. For those that know the story, there's probably no mystery here, but for others, this is going to be a surprise for you. So what are we talking about tonight?
Tonight's case is about Charles Stewart, who was traveling with his wife after going to Lamaze class. And according to him, while they were stopped at a stoplight, a man approached the car with a gun intending to rob them. And it ends up where Charles Stewart is shot in the stomach and his then pregnant wife is shot in the head by this assailant.
So this is 1989, October 23rd in the great Boston, Mass. So just 30 minutes after they left the Brigham Women's Hospital for her Lamaze class, because she was 7 months pregnant, they're driving around town, and that's when he calls 911. And this phone call lasts about 13 minutes. And he's trying to give the police officers his location. He's telling them that he's been shot, his wife's been shot. It's a really brutal phone call. And he's calling from his car phone. This is 1989. So this is early days of car phones. But just knowing that he has a car phone, you know that those were pretty expensive at the time. They were about $1,000. And then you didn't get any minutes with that. So you had to pay for minutes, which were about $1 a minute. In today's money, that's $2,000 for that phone and about $2 a minute. But during the duration of the call, he is not really sure where he is. So he drives down the street a little bit to find a street sign. He gives them a street name, but they don't know the cross street. So they have squad cars all up and down this street. And Charles Stewart has now become unresponsive, has dropped the phone. But the call is still connected. It's still live. So the dispatchers could hear the police sirens, but they knew they had like 4 or 5 cars out there. So they started having them shut off all their sirens and then turn them on one at a time. And they knew where each patrol car was. So they listened. And when they finally heard the sirens, they knew which car it was, where he was, and they could tell that car, hey, you're the closest. Look around for a Toyota Crescenta. So they're able to find his car and get emergency services there. They find just a horrible scene. His wife's been shot in the head, but she was still alive. Really, there was no way that she was going to make it.
Yeah, she was slumped over and she was unconscious. The type of injuries she sustained, she wasn't likely to make it.
They have to do a emergency cesarean on her. They deliver this baby who's, you know, 2 months premature. It's a baby boy and he's got to be put in ICU and is under observation because it's a horrible situation.
The boy who was given the name that the parents had wished that he would be given, Christopher, had suffered trauma and oxygen deprivation and was having breathing issues.
Now, Charles was shot in the torso, in his stomach. He suffered a critical wound. That's why he couldn't stay on the 911 call very well. He was passing out while talking to them. He has to be put in emergency surgery for them to remove the bullet, and he's in critical condition for about 10 days.
He ended up spending 6 weeks in the hospital and had 2 surgeries. Very serious injury here. 3 of his organs were damaged by this shot. So when the cops are trying to figure out what happened, and he had been able to tell them something of a description of the suspect, they had to run with it, right?
Yeah, they had a limited amount of time before he went into surgery. So it was right when they got to his vehicle, transported him to the hospital, and from there, they went with this description.
Now, at the time when the authorities are approaching the vehicle, the emergency services were also at the scene, and with them was a TV crew.
Rescue 911.
Yeah, and they were traveling with this with emergency services that evening, and they were able to film this vehicle and its occupants. They got footage of 30-year-old Carol Stewart and 29-year-old Charles Stewart. And it's a horrific scene. And of course, the police are telling them, hey, get out of our way. We've got work to do. And the media, this TV crew here, would make it a point to say later that they were bossing them around and telling them to move out of the way and stop filming. But then later, they wanted their footage and were saying, oh, I wish you'd gotten more of this.
The old TV show Rescue 911, it's out on YouTube. You can find it. I think it's a 3-parter for the Charles Stewart piece. I was watching it with my wife and she was like, is this a reenactment? I'm like, no, this is real footage. How did they get real footage? I'm like, they just happened to be there when this went down. So you can hear that 911 call and you can see Charles being toted into the hospital on a gurney.
Yeah, this is not a common occurrence where you actually have a lot of available media on a case. And in this one, you have the 911 call, which is complete online. You can hear it on YouTube. And then you also have this footage that was taken right after the shooting, essentially. And it's just a devastating bit of footage there.
So Charles is able to tell them that it was a black male wearing a tracksuit. He had a raspy voice, and he gives great detail about this, down to what kind of gun it was, to the stripes on his tracksuit and his height, along with the description that Charles gives the police. He says that they were robbed and that the man stole his wife's purse and jewelry. At the time of the robbery, Charles says the assailant asks if he's 5'0", and then pulls the trigger, shooting him. For a man that's been shot, he remembers a lot about his attacker. And the police are really happy with this because they're able to get a very good description of the suspect and roll with it. The first suspect they come across is Alan Swanson, who happens to be a black man who owns a tracksuit. That's all that connects him to this case. Interest in him is short-lived because they find a new suspect to go after.
The car was in an area of town known as Mission Hill, and it wasn't known to be a very good area. And so the way the police saw it was, whoever this raspy-voiced man was, he was probably from that area. Because after all, he showed up on foot. Of course, the mayor wants something done immediately. What it is they have the media reporting about this well-to-do couple traveling in a car and then being shot. The woman is dead, and then her baby is basically near death. And then the husband looks like he's going to make it, but this is a terrible event. And no one wants the perpetrator of this crime to get away. So the mayor is saying, we're going to get this guy. Whoever did this, we're coming for you. They send what amounts to what, like 100 police officers into Mission Hill?
Yeah, it's a saturation patrol where they canvass the area. But on top of that, they stop and frisk pretty much every black male that's out of this housing project or that lives in this neighborhood. And there's hundreds of them from ages 12 to 60. It's a very aggressive movement that they do. They're given this direction from the mayor and the public outcry for this heinous act. When a officer does a stop and frisk or a Terry frisk, or when they do a stop and identify, they have to give reasonable and articulable reasons of suspicion of criminal activity that has been or is being committed. If they have this, which it doesn't take much to do that, you have to comply. It is not against the law for them to ask you questions and give you a Terry frisk. But this is supposed to be for suspicion of a current criminal activity, or they suspect you in a past criminal activity. But this goes on for weeks. And I understand that if somebody robs a bank down the street, the perpetrator is wearing a black hoodie, and that's the description given. Well, if you're a male that fits that description in that area for the next half day, I get it. They're going to want to talk to you because you match a description. But weeks later, how long do we give this active investigation? How long do we give them the authority and the probable cause to stop you and ask you or frisk you for a crime that happened days ago or weeks ago? So the neighborhood is not appreciating this at all, and it's very aggressive.
And by aggressive, I mean, we have to say that there were reports that people were even being strip searched
on the side of the road.
And the way this comes off is there's this neighborhood, and sure, they have their issues, but because of the report that a man had shot a woman and a man going back home after Lamaze class, the police descended upon this neighborhood and literally just brought the full force of the Boston Police Department down on it in a way that is just not common. And it's based on one crime. You have to keep in mind, in this same area, they had other people shot that same day, but no police descended en masse like this.
And the problem I see is there's a a group of guys standing on a corner or a black man walking down the street, he fits whatever description, whatever vague description that's been given. Well, we know that he's probably not the shooter, but by giving him a Terry frisk, they can now find drugs or weapons if he possibly has that on him. And then once they find those drugs or weapons, then they use that to leverage it against him and say, hey, do you know anything about the shooting, or were you involved with the shooting? It's not really to find a street confession. It's to pretty much harass others and get them to give you information. So this is why people don't appreciate it, because they know they don't fit the description. They know that this is just to get information out of them, which a knock and talk or just interacting with the public would have sufficed.
Yeah, the police are looking for names. They're looking for any kind of information they can get so they can get this case solved now, because that's what the mayor wants. While they're doing all this, it's almost as though the neighborhood is suffering from it. But on the other hand, there are a lot of people in Mission Hill who care about what happened and are concerned, and they would like to see it solved as well. They're probably of two minds about it. One, there's a lot of abuse going on in Mission Hill because of this incident. But on the other hand, they would like to see it solved.
It gets so heated that the mayor and other city officials start talking about bringing back the death penalty specifically for cases like this.
Yeah, they didn't have the death penalty active at the time. It's just like anything else. You say, well, I don't believe in the death penalty, but there's always a crime that most people will say, okay, fine, I would agree to the death penalty in this one case because this was just too heinous. And there was even a Democrat in the city who came out on the side of death penalty in this case, stating, they catch the perpetrator of this crime, I'll flip the switch myself.
Nothing like anger and revenge to bring people together.
Yeah, and this, what it really is, and I'm sure some of you listening to this will say, well, no, I would want them to go out and do whatever they could to find who murdered this poor woman and had shot her husband. On the other hand, we have to stop and think for a moment. What if all this accosting of the citizenry is causing more problems than it's solving?
And also, if you give up your rights, you won't get them back.
Yeah, what kind of precedent does this set when you say, someone was shot, it's terrible, her baby's going to die, what are we going to do here? Well, we need to go find the perpetrator. So let's send 100 police down there and we'll shake everybody down until we get answers. What if this is what's going to happen every time out, that the mayor is just, he's just so passionate about a case and says, that's it, we're going to send the entire Boston police into this area, just shake everyone down and just force them to talk. We'll get answers. I mean, how many times does this have to happen before we say, yeah, this is normal?
Well, when you look at stats on stop and frisk, about 85 to 90% of the people that were stopped and frisked weren't doing anything wrong. So you're looking at between 10 and 15% of them had drugs or something, some kind of contraband on them. So that's a kind of a low rate, low success rate there.
Charles was in the hospital. He knew his wife was dead. He wrote her a letter. And then he also heard that his son was not expected to make it. So he requested to be able to visit with him before he passed away. And of course, everyone was so concerned about Charles and about his son. They transported him to go and visit Christopher, and he was able to hold him before he died. So a very, very emotional recovery. As Charles is getting better, he's already lost his wife, his son dies, and so even though he's going to make it, he's lost his entire family. And on top of that, the police believe they have found the suspect who had shot both Charles and his wife, Carol.
In December, a man named Willie Bennett, he was actually an ex-con. He had a record. He was from the area. He was in his late 30s. He had a raspy voice. This seems to be a good match. But what's really keyed the police off to him is his younger nephew said, oh yeah, that was Willie. Willie shot those people. So his nephew is bragging about what his uncle's doing.
The next step is the police need to get Willie in front of Charles Stewart so that he can identify him. They do this with a police lineup. By this point, Charles is well enough to be able to walk around. He takes a look at the lineup and he picks out Willie Bennett immediately.
Now, the other people in the lineup were mostly African-American police officers, and Willie wasn't quite as well-groomed as everybody else in the lineup. Charles is very convincing, and he says that's the man that did it. So this is big news. This horrible demon that has plagued society has been caught, and he's going to face justice. Hooray.
Yeah, the shakedown in Mission Hill proved successful, right?
We got some useful information that led to an arrest. After this perpetrator has been identified, Charles's brother comes forward and says, I helped him. Willie Bennett is not the person that did this. Charles Stewart is the guilty party.
We're brought to you by ZipRecruiter. So the other day, Aaron and I were trying to get concert tickets to a show we really wanted to see. And I waited before I bought my ticket. And guess what? I missed my chance. And that's why you have to act quickly or somebody else will get it instead. It's like hiring for your business. If you want to find the most talented people for your roles, you have to scoop them up before the competition does. So that's why the best way to do that is ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles, and immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Field of Greens. I like eating healthy, and I've tried a lot of different supplements. I've tried juicing, and I've spent a lot of money and wasted a lot of time. And let me tell you, honestly, none of those things ever made me feel better. With Field of Greens, it's a superfood that gives you nutrition the way nature intended. It's packed full of organic fruits and vegetables, not extracts. And when you're getting those nutrients, you can sleep better, notice things like your hair and your nails feel stronger, helps with digestion. You just feel better overall. My favorite flavor is the strawberry lemonade. I have a feeling you're going to love this product the way I do. But if for some reason you don't like it, they give you a 100% money-back guarantee. Plus, you can get 15% off your first order and free rush shipping. Visit fieldofgreens.com and use the promo code GenY. Promo code GenY at fieldofgreens.com. Fieldofgreens.com. Go check it out.
It just doesn't ring true for a lot of people because the injury that Charles Stewart sustained was so serious. I mean, why would he shoot himself in the stomach? That's a horrible alibi to create, right? Because he could have died.
Oh, he almost died, actually. If the emergency services hadn't got there in time, he would have died that night.
And it's not like he said, I'm at this intersection, come get me. He couldn't give a real description. And as Justin pointed out, the dispatcher did a great job of figuring out which police vehicle was nearest to their car so they could say, yeah, you're the closest one, so they could kind of get an idea where to go. It wasn't like he was able to set this up perfectly. It just doesn't seem right. They already arrested a guy and he was known to commit armed robbery. So why are they now focusing on Charles Stewart? His brother, Matthew Stewart, after the shooting, had actually traveled to California.
Matthew, what makes his story very convincing is he says, I went and met him and got the gun, got the purse, and got the jewelry. And he put it in a bag for me and tossed it in my car. That's why you weren't able to find any of those items in the car.
And of course, by coming forward with this information, Matthew Stewart is implicating himself as an accessory to the crime.
Exactly. So this is pretty compelling. And when Matthew's able to produce some of this physical evidence, that's when prosecutors turn around and put out an indictment
for Charles.
Yeah, it was late January 3rd, 1990, when Matthew Stewart approached the authorities with this information and told them where he had thrown the items off the bridge, but he didn't throw everything off the bridge.
So that night, Charles Stewart checks into the Sheraton Terra Motel in Braintree, and he requests a 4:30 a.m. wake-up call. That's pretty early.
So this is January 4th, 1990. At 2 in the morning, he walks to a gas station convenience store nearby. And while he's in there, the employees are looking at him because, well, at that time in the morning, they don't get too many people coming in. It's said that they're worried about possibly getting robbed. So they really try to be alert and check out anybody that comes in so they have descriptions. They said this guy walks in and he's just grinning ear to ear and he's just very, very happy. And he buys a soda and a snack and he makes a little chit chat with them. And then he says, hey, I might come back. I might need another snack or something. He walks out, but he doesn't come back.
And he then drives out into Boston with his brand new $22,000 Nissan Maxima to the Tobin Bridge. And he stops his car on the bridge and turns on his hazards.
Charles Stewart had found out that his brother had talked to the police.
It was all over the news. Charles leaves a note on his car seat, and he takes a several hundred foot dive off the Tobin Bridge to his death. Leaving his car on the bridge, there's no shoulder here. So he's literally blocking traffic, and they have to shut down the entire bridge.
Yeah, Charles had become a very desperate man. When he found out what his brother was doing, the first thing he did was he contacted the family lawyer. And that lawyer said, well, I've already spoken with Matthew, and I can't represent either one of you. This is just a conflict of interest. I represent this family. And now that you two are at odds, I'm stepping out. His family lawyer did say, here are some names of lawyers who you could contact who could represent you. Of course, he didn't contact them. The note that he left behind, this was not a confession letter. This was a, I love my family, but the allegations are too much for me. There are no answers in this suicide letter.
I guess, how does one come to this conclusion? How does one bring themselves to ask their family, hey, help me knock off my pregnant wife, and somehow think this is normal, and then have the audacity to blame a poor minority group in the area and then falsely accuse a man of doing this?
Well, he did ask his family because his brother Michael, just weeks before this happened, had said that Charles had asked him to help him murder his wife.
In a bar.
And you ask yourself, what kind of person feels comfortable enough asking their brothers to help them either murder their wife or just aid them in committing the crime in some way by disposing evidence?
This is astonishing to me. Then after his wife is murdered, for his family to not speak up. And it's not all the members of the family that are in the know. It's mainly his brothers. It was right before his brother came forward. It was January 2nd. Michael had telephoned their half-sister, Shelley, and she told him about the brother, Matthew, and that they were going to tell their parents. And Shelley said, we're going to tell mom and dad. And Michael's like, what are you going to tell them? He says, we're going to tell them that Charles was involved. We're not going to say that he killed her. And Michael says, you're right. Shelley says, okay. So there's more than just a couple family members here. I don't know how they could all be so complicit in this.
Yeah, I can't help but think that the death of this woman and her son just didn't weigh that heavy on this family. It just doesn't feel that way. And I know that Carol Stewart's family, the Demedes, were consoled by members of the Stewart family. And yet some of those family members knew at the time they were trying to console them that Charles, their family member, was involved in this, was responsible for it. I mean, that gives you a sick feeling knowing that these people are like, oh, I'm so sorry that this happened to you. You know, we're here for you. And yet they knew Charles was the one that had done the crime.
So Charles Stewart was very well to do, but he wasn't always that way. He was actually born in Reading, Massachusetts, December 1959. His parents were blue collar and they lived outside of Boston. He had attended Northeast Metropolitan Regional Vocational School, specializing in culinary arts. He was average guy, graduated 77 and worked at an Italian restaurant. I think it was called the Driftwood in Revere. He enrolled in Salem State College, attended there until 79, and then dropped out. He was known to tell people that he attended Brown University and played football, but dropped out after injury, which he never went to Brown, and he never really played football. He said he completed his education at Salem State, although Salem State says he never went there.
Yeah, he actually played baseball and basketball, not football. But this is a clear sign right here that Charles Stewart wanted to be more impressive than he actually was. So he would lie about the universities that he attended. He would lie about what programs he was in. What we do know about him, though, is he was very passionate about the culinary arts. And he was known to be a good student. And anybody that ever had any dealings with him in school or in sports all said he worked hard. He wasn't always the best at what he did, but he showed up and he competed the best he could.
But he would make himself sound far more important or successful than he really was. I guess you got to fake it till you make it.
Yeah, Carol Demedi was born in March of 1959. She was from Medford, Massachusetts, which is just outside of Boston. She was always known to be outgoing, was a cheerleader in high school, graduated from Boston College in 1981. She later got a law degree in 86 from Suffolk University in downtown Boston. She was actually a waitress when she met Charles Stewart, and they hit it off right away. So while Charles was working towards his culinary aspirations, he got a job at a furrier, a fur store. Carol went through graduate school. In 85, they were married at St. James Church in Medford. Carol Demedi would later get a job as a tax lawyer at a publishing company.
Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Quince. Do you need to upgrade your wardrobe or home essentials at an unbeatable price? Well, Quince has you covered with timeless pieces that never go out of style, and you'll have them in your closet forever. And the best part? All Quince items are priced 50 to 80% off less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman, passes the savings on to you, and Quince only works with factories that are safe, ethical, with responsible manufacturing practices. Along with premium fabrics and finishes, how can you not love that? I recently got a duvet cover and a pair of awesome relaxed jeans. They're stretchy too. You can find all kinds of stuff at Quince. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/GenY for free shipping on your first order and 365-day returns. That's Quince, Quince.com/GenY to get free shipping and 365-day returns. Quince.com/GenY.
Really, you can see at this point, while Charles was a manager for a fur store and was making good money, Carol was a lawyer and doing very well. So with their combined incomes, they were pretty well off.
Exactly.
The thing here is that on the night she was shot, she was 7 months pregnant. And it came out that Charles was not very excited about her pregnancy for a couple of reasons. One, I don't think he wanted a child because it was known that he was asking her to get an abortion. And she would not agree to that. She really wanted a child. And second of all, she was, I don't know if she was hinting or just outright telling him, but she was considering not going back to work as a lawyer. She was thinking about staying home with the baby.
This would cut into their finances because Charles was very materialistic. A Toyota Cressida was considered the luxury model at the time. It was between $16,000 and $19,000. Today's money, that's over $30,000. The Carphone, again, that's like $1,000 back in 89, plus you had to pay for minutes. After the shooting, he bought a brand new Nissan Maxima that was over $20,000. A guy was really into flaunting money, showing off cash, exaggerating his self-worth. It's very American Psycho-ish to me.
He was also working toward opening his own restaurant. He had attended a course at the Boston Center for Adult Education. The course was titled Buying and Operating a Restaurant Successfully. And it was known that he had dreams of opening his own restaurant. And so if his wife is staying home with the child, then her whole income drops away and he can't open a restaurant. I mean, that's not something you just do. I mean, you need the money, you need the backing to do it. And so if he and she both have their incomes, then it's a possibility.
But this baby is going to be his dream killer.
So he takes out a policy on her. Because of her career, she's a lawyer. She already has, I think, about an $82,000 policy on herself. So if she dies, he would receive $82,000. But he takes out a $100,000 policy on her before he commits this crime.
And that's very telling that he takes out a life insurance policy on his wife, who then later is murdered, but he's not investigated. He's not looked into.
This happens near enough the time when she is killed that it should have been a red flag, I would think. I mean, you could say it's racism because he's the white guy and he gets shot by a black man, or the fact that he was injured so severely that the police just take him at his word. But really, there were hints leading up to this incident that should have prompted people to come forward. And quite honestly, some people did. Some people called and tried to report on him and said, you know, I think he did this, or I really think you need to take a look at him because of this or because of that. In September of 1989, David McLean, a friend of his, said that Charles Stewart told him that he realized that his wife now had the upper hand in their marriage. Because she was pregnant, and everybody knew it, she now could make certain things happen, and he couldn't do anything about it. The first hint is he asked her to get an abortion, and she's saying no. So he has no control over this. And now, of course, the finances are threatened. But that's not the only person that had a hint that Charles was not so happy with his wife.
There was talk of a girlfriend on the side. It was a woman by the name of Deborah Allen, who was 23 years old, a graduate student, and worked at the fur store. It's really rumors and gossip, but it's said that Charles ended up buying a 24-karat gold brooch for her, and that he went out and bought diamond rings later. Now, where these diamond rings are, do we have a receipt for them? No. But these are the things that have been said. If he's unhappy with his marriage, well, this might be the reason why, right?
Right. A lot of people had commented that this Deborah Allen was very attractive and that it was very, very clear that Charles had a thing for her. And so, as an outsider looking in, I could completely see how maybe he's pursuing her, but she's not really going for him. Some people point out, though, that when he's at the hospital, she is calling him and checking on him. And she's called him many times while he's in the hospital, too, right?
Well, your coworkers call and check on you when you're injured.
But I also say, even if there was something developing between these two, as soon as she realized that he had murdered his wife and his son, she wanted nothing to do with him.
Yeah.
So linked or not, the thing that bothers me about this is she has no impact on this case, right? I mean, do you think there's any link here between her and the crime that was committed?
I see more links between his family members and the crime than I do her.
So I'm wondering why she keeps getting brought into this. And for me, I just don't really get it.
It's motive for him. That's all. It's really inconsequential when it's all said and done because he wasn't on trial.
Well, the motive for him, as I see it, is he murdered his wife so that he could collect almost $200,000 in insurance so that he could open his own restaurant and he could maintain his lifestyle. Deborah Allen is just, for him, maybe icing on the cake, but I don't know that she's a motivator.
It's just part of the motive is he's unhappy in his marriage. It's not going in the direction he wants it to. He's losing his control. And this is the younger hot thing that he could move to once it's all said and done.
It doesn't work out for him because, as I said, as soon as Deborah catches wind about what's actually happened, she doesn't want anything to do with Charles Stewart and she doesn't want to talk about him.
Yeah. Now, his brother was able to show the police where the gun was and they were able to recover it. So this really proves that he was involved. There's physical evidence. He has knowledge of the crime that nobody else should have known. What else did his brother know and reveal here?
Well, Matthew Stewart talked. You know, he spilled the beans. He talked to authorities. He also talked to his lawyer. It's really his lawyer that is giving out all this information to where the media and the people can pick it up. His lawyer said that the original plan was Matthew was offered $10,000 to partake in an insurance scam, which would be a fake robbery. And that days before, he had done a dry run with Charles to practice. And neighbors, friends reported that they know that the two of them had attempted to rob their own home, Charles's home. There were stories that people thought maybe if you look at what happened, maybe they had planned to do a robbery gone wrong at the home where the house was robbed and Carol was killed there. This is just a rumor or a theory. It's not an actual, it's not actually proven. The lawyer knows a lot. The lawyer has a good sense of everything that had gone on. And of course, I think the family is somewhat guarded. They eventually, of course, talked a bit about knowing what they knew about Charles. But I mean, it came out after Willie Bennett had already been run through by the police. So what he was supposed to do, because the plan had changed, Matthew met him near the hospital and he got the snub-nosed revolver, the 38, as well as Carol Stewart's Gucci bag and her jewelry. According to Matthew, he thought it was just an insurance scam. I'm thinking, what does this have to do with the murder of Carol Stewart? And I don't think it really makes much sense. I think the truth is that Matthew knew what was going on. And I also think that Michael knew what was going on. I think Michael had declined him, but it also declined telling the authorities about what was going to happen. So you can see how this family seems complicit. And I like the fact that his lawyer had come out and tried to clear the air on a lot of things, letting them know, you know, Matthew was involved, that he had a part in this. He disposed of evidence. But of course, I'm sure he has it the other way too, where he says, hey, he didn't have to come forward. He could have just held on and not said anything because the police already had a suspect. What do you think about that, Justin? He did come forward and he did seem to give up a lot of information and showed him where he dumped things and they were able to find a lot of it. Has he redeemed himself at all by doing that?
Well, the law saw it that way. They only charged him with fraud and conspiracy, but not as an accessory to murder. They did give him leniency for coming forward, and he was the only family member charged. After being paroled, he didn't live a very good life. At age 45, he was found dead outside of a homeless shelter. He had a rough life. I'm sure the whole Stewart family had pretty rough lives, including the Demedi family. But yeah, I think that he tried to redeem himself. I think in the law's eyes, he redeemed himself. But I still look at this like, okay, you sit on your hands knowing that your brother has murdered a woman and a child, but it's the accusing someone wrongly that finally brings you out as, oh, I got to put a stop to this. Hey, I'm glad he came forward. I'm glad we didn't have Willie Bennett sitting behind bars the rest of his life, or even being put to death if they did some emergency death penalty thing. But what does it take? I don't agree with them being complicit at all, really.
Yeah, they can't charge Charles Stewart. He's dead. And they go after Matthew Stewart a little bit, but, you know, he's the guy that gave them all the information. The police didn't investigate Charles. I'm sorry. There's just nothing there to show that they really investigated him. They took him at his word. And I'm wondering how many people would have, given the seriousness of his injuries. But what really bothers me is that you have the Dimitti family who's lost Carol. At the funeral, Michael and Matthew were pallbearers. So they're carrying her casket. And they know that Charles murdered her. Just the idea of that is disgusting. They should not have been touching her casket at all. And worse yet, at the funeral, Charles, who we know is the murderer in this case, he had written a letter to his dead wife talking about how he loved her so much. In the letter, which was read by a friend since he couldn't read it, "Now you sleep away from me. I will never again know the feeling of your hand in mine, but I will always feel you. I miss you and I love you. In our souls, we must forgive this sinner because God would too."
It's so disgusting to me, hearing the words in retrospect.
I mean, he's the one who did it, so he's already planting the idea that we need to forgive this person.
Mm-hmm.
Either he didn't expect to be caught, or if he did get caught, he wanted there to be some mercy.
Yeah, but I think it's arrogance, and he didn't expect to be caught. He thought he was this mastermind, and he told half his family what he was doing. Like, come on, man.
We need to talk more about William Bennett. Before we move on to that, though, let's just be clear. Charles Stewart, before he had killed himself, had bought a new Nissan Maxima, and he had gotten the money, the insurance money from Carol's work, which was $80-some thousand. The $100,000, according to what I was able to dig up, was never actually paid out to him, although one paper had reported that it was, but that was denied.
It takes a little bit of time for the payout, and this is a very short amount of time between the attack and the truth coming out. So, yeah, they didn't pay it out because by the time they would have paid it out, they knew the truth.
Let's talk about William Bennett, because I know that some people are quick to point out that he has a criminal past. There were accusations of armed robbery. He was also arrested around the time of the murder for a robbery, which he denies being a part of. When they went to go pick him up, Justin, his family says that he wasn't even home. 15 officers with shields in front of them came at the house, and they used a sledgehammer or something like it to break down the door. And they literally just
trashed the place.
Yeah, they just went through the house and just threw stuff around, broke stuff, and were wanting answers. Where is he?
I've watched a lot of the first 48, where, you know, you watch the first 48 hours after a homicide is committed. It's a decent show. And I've seen cops go and do knock and talks where they're told this person who just shot three people the night before is at. Now, I think a little bit of this is, at the time of the robbery, Charles had said that the assailant said, "Are you 5-0 before he shot him, meaning he thought he was a cop, and so he shot him. I guess that's literally Charles planting that seed of, he's armed and dangerous, and you need to come with loaded for bear, guns blazing, when you find him, because he's dangerous.
Charles had said right before he pulled the trigger, he said, "You're 5-0. That, and you're right, he planted that seed. The cops already had it in their minds that this guy was willing to kill because he thought he was dealing with a police officer.
I think this is Charles's plan to have whoever they thought the suspect was be killed in the process of apprehension.
And that's a scary thought. He could have gotten away with this, because we already know that Matthew wouldn't have come forward if the wrong person hadn't been arrested or if no one had been arrested. He was just going to sit on his hands. After he had disposed of the jewelry and the gun, he took off for California. He left. Charles could have gotten away with this.
And after this all goes down, Mayor Flynn issues an apology, public apology, to Bennett's family and to everyone that lives in the Mission Hill neighborhood. Funny enough, no more talk about bringing back the death penalty. So you can infer what you want there.
Well, according to the Bennett family, Mayor Flynn also visited them. Willie's brother said that one of the things that occurred was his mother offered the mayor a chair to sit down on, but he declined the offer. So imagine he's there to try and express his regrets, I guess, about how everything went down, but he won't sit with them. He's standing there. And I think all that did was let them know that all their fears about how the authorities viewed people in this area, or you can even take it this far, how the authorities might view minorities, may be true. Because when Mayor Flynn went to go talk with them, they didn't get the sense that he was very, very regretful about his actions and about his words and about his decisions.
It's the simple body language and nuance of these political faux pas that tell them everything they need to know.
And Mayor Flynn, not only that, but when he apologizes, he keeps referencing Charles Stewart as the guy that pulled the wool over everyone's eyes, as if to say, look, this is the guy that did everything. I didn't do anything. I'm just trying to help out. But who made the decision to send 100 officers into the area and start shaking people down and strip searching them and accosting them, even if they didn't match the description? This is an abuse here, an abuse of power. And it's only happening in this area. It's not happening in one of these nicer neighborhoods.
And this isn't just a problem with a police officer. This is a issue with the commands coming from the top down, telling the police force to do this. You can't exactly hate the player. You got to hate the game, because they're given orders. They're given commands. They're being told, that Fourth Amendment, that doesn't really matter so much. And this is the full force of the government that you can see coming down on the population.
Now, I don't want to make it seem like Boston never learned a lesson. At least in the years since, there have been a lot of changes made. In my opinion, it seems like there have been some advances there. And I think part of that is just you get new people into power. You get people who know more, understand more about the importance of people's rights. And so over time, some of the lesser qualities are sort of washed away just by time, just by progress. The Dimitti family established a foundation, the Carol Dimitti Stewart Foundation, and it provides scholarships for needy students in Mission Hill. I watched an interview with her brother, and he was talking about how their family understands the problems that arose in Mission Hill from this incident. So not only did they lose Carol, but they understood what the people of Mission Hill went through because of what happened, because of what Charles Stewart did. They felt empathy for them. And so by establishing this foundation, students in the area could qualify for scholarships to go to college. And they really feel like that's a positive to take from such a negative event, is they're just trying to connect with people who have all gone through something here because of Charles Stewart's actions and because of the way the authorities reacted to it. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Generation Y podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Welcome to the small town of Chinook, where faith runs deep and secrets run deeper. In this new thriller, available exclusively on Wondery Plus, religion and crime collide when a gruesome murder rocks the isolated Montana community. Everyone is quick to point their fingers at a drug-addicted teenager, but local deputy Ruth Vogel isn't convinced. She suspects connections to a powerful religious group. Enter federal agent V.B. Loro, who has been investigating a local church for possible criminal activity. The pair form an unlikely partnership to catch the killer, unearthing secrets that leave Ruth torn between her duty to the law, her religious convictions, and her very own family. But something more sinister than murder is afoot, and someone is watching Ruth. With an all-star cast led by Emmy nominee Sanaa Lathan and Star Wars Kelly Marie Tran, Chinook is available exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.